We'll turn now to Vote America v. Schwab, 23-3100.
Presiding Judge Hartz, and may it please the court, I am Brad Schlossman representing the state of Kansas defendants in this matter. The thrust of this case is whether a third party, like the Voter Participation Center, has a First Amendment right to pre-fill someone else's advance ballot application. And assuming that such a First Amendment right does exist, what sort of deference is owed to the state? The answer to that first question, in our judgment, is an emphatic no. A third party pre-filling an application of someone else entails neither speech nor expressive conduct. Any message comes from the cover letter in this case, not from the application itself. There is nothing expressive about inserting a voter's name and address on the voter's own application. Not only is the cover letter separable from the application, but there is nothing intrinsic on the application itself that would necessitate its partial pre-population in order to convey VPC's message.
When you say separable, they come in the same envelope for a reason, right?
Yes, it's a part of a mailing package where they include the cover letter, and then inside of it is a application as well as an envelope that has its pre-addressed and prepaid.
And the reason is because you have to look at each of the submissions inside the envelope to understand what's going on.
Well, that is correct. But that also makes it clear in the explanatory cover letter. That's what tells the voter why it's included and why and their message. The statute here doesn't actually include, it doesn't prohibit them from including a blank application. It doesn't include them from explaining anything that they want to, from sending it anything they want to. But any expressive conduct would come from the cover letter itself explaining why that material is included in the overall package.
What if the package didn't have it pre-filled but had a separate sheet with little sticky labels, and one was name, and it said, peel this off and put it in blank number 6. Would that be okay?
Under our statute, as long as the application itself is not pre-filled, then I don't believe that would violate the statute.
So this is all coming down to whether or not it's already typed in or whether you have a separate label that you peel off and try to put into the right space and may screw up and cause all kinds of problems by putting it in the wrong space?
The reason this statute came about, Your Honor, is that in the 2020 election, there were a significant number of errors that were included in the pre-populated applications that VPC sent out. We had approximately 15 to 25,000 that were sent to voters that were erroneous. 5% of the applications that they sent out included an erroneous middle initial or name. 3%, which is about 25,000 applications, 3% include a suffix. And if those are sent in and it's incorrect on the application, that can disenfranchise voters. Because if any part of that application is completed incorrectly, then the county election office is required to reject the application and the voter is not going to be able to get an advance ballot.
I thought before they were required to reject it, they were required to reach out to the person who sent in the erroneous information.
That's correct, Your Honor. Kansas has an elaborate cure mechanism, but of course that is a very time-consuming process for the county election officials. When it is sent to the voters erroneously, it causes and did cause very significant confusion and frustration.
And in certain cases, if there's just a small error, a letter left off, a Jim rather than a James, something like that, the election official is able to just disregard the error. Isn't that right?
That is correct.
What did the record show as to the number of those types of errors?
Well, the record didn't talk about what those, the record talked about simply what the errors that were sufficient enough to warrant an outright rejection of the application. And what the VPC's expert came in, one of their witnesses came in and said that overall, nationally, they had, again, 5% of the applications that they had pre-filled were included an erroneous middle name or middle initial. And there's no question that an erroneous middle name or middle initial or an erroneous suffix, you know, it's saying junior when it's not a junior or senior versus, you know, the third, whatever, that that would cause a rejection of that application if it was sent in to the county election office.
That would require rejection, you're saying.
I'm sorry, say again.
I'm a little confused. You're saying that would require rejection?
Yes, that is correct.
But I thought you answered Judge Carson that if it's a, using J instead of Jim or
right,
Jim,
well,
so James didn't require rejection.
Yeah,
does it or doesn't it?
What the county election officials who testified said if it is clear from the application that it is that individual. So when someone puts in James Smith and it's this address, then that and he's in the election records is Jim Smith, then that will, you know, if the county election official is able to discern that that, in fact, is that voter. But when you have individuals where it says John Q. Jones as opposed to John T. Jones, that's a different individual.
Okay, so of the, you said 5% of the ones that came in were incorrectly filled out. Do you know how many of those were rejected? Do you know how many of those were accepted on their face, even though it wasn't filled out correctly? It didn't cause a problem because the election official said, oh, this is clearly James Smith.
No, and so let me make a couple of things clear, Your Honor. Okay. Number one, the numbers were their numbers overall, so what they had said was is that they didn't know the exact numbers in Kansas, but they didn't deny, you know, no one knows for certain how many of that came in Kansas. But the reality is that we don't know for certain because of the elaborate cure mechanisms that we do have in the state. When an election official goes in, you know, a very lengthy, complex process to call up the voter, writes them and says, hey, you know, we got this. It looks like it's the wrong address or the wrong name. I mean, eventually it may well have been cured, but that was only after a very significant time frame.
Does the record indicate how much time and effort was spent because of errors?
Yes, there is testimony in the stipulated facts that election officials could spend as much an individual application when they had to call. I mean, it depended on what stage it was. It could be up to 30 minutes for each application that included erroneous information where they had to contact the voter.
Okay, but that's interesting that it could take that long.
Yeah.
And there were this many where it could have happened. Do we know if, in fact, election officials were spending considerable amounts of time caused by improperly pre-filled applications?
Yes, there is testimony in the record from Andrew Howell, the election commissioner for Shawnee County. There is...
What did he say about the time?
He said that it was an extremely time-consuming process, that he was having to deal with voters who were either confused and frustrated about the applications that they were getting that had been pre-filled. And also, we talked about the amount of time that he was having to spend dealing with the curative process.
So that I'm sure I understand,
yeah,
is the problem with the James and the Jim and so forth that the information that's pre-filled differs from the Elvis information?
Yes.
And so, okay, correct. And so if the voter solicitation people cured that problem and went solely with Elvis, then all of what you just said goes poof.
Well,
there's no problem with pre-filled at that point.
There could be a problem. Number one, let's be clear that that's not what happened, that they were using an outside vendor who merged.
I understand, conceded
but,
that point,
okay.
But I'm asking,
okay,
the crisis that's being described here as far as time spent and wasted and upset people and so forth, if the information pre-filled matched Elvis, which is possible, that can be done, then goodbye to your argument.
Goodbye what now?
Well, do you have an argument at that point?
Well, yeah. I mean, the state still has in the 2020 election, there was very substantial confusion and frustration and anger among the voters, and the burden on the plaintiff's conduct, I mean, in our judgment, is incidental at best. I mean, all we're talking about is the prefilled application. And when you look at cases like O'Brien, when you look, I mean, I think there would be Anderson Burdick anyway, but I think that this test that the Supreme Court has applied to these contexts, it's basically a rational basis test. And that's what, as you know, the Sixth Circuit held in the recent Lichtenstein case.
Let me phrase this question differently.
Sure.
There'd be no problem for the state if the statute said you can't file, you can't send pre-filled applications unless the pre-filled information is from Elvis. That would solve your problem.
I think that would help the problem. I mean, you'd still have the issue of timing. So when, as our expert witness talked about, they were pre-printing the applications, you know, early in the year in 2020. And at that point, because Elvis is a dynamic system, it changes in real time, you would have individuals who had moved, who had changed their name, maybe a marriage or whatever. So when they were getting the applications, it was obsolete. I mean, that information had changed since the time that the pre-filled application had been printed. But yes, I will concede that if it was strictly based on that information, that would go a long way towards addressing the state's issues. That's not what occurred here, though.
Also, you said filling out a form is not expensive activity. Normally, you think of anything someone writes as equivalent to speech. Do you have any authority that there's no First Amendment interest in filling out an application?
I would first look to the City of Austin case, where the Supreme Court made clear that merely words on a page don't make it into the First Amendment regime. And that was one of the things that the district court argued is, well, it's words on a page. But, I mean, the court has said that that's not enough. There needs to be, the message needs to be overwhelmingly apparent. We cited the court in Rumsfeld even cited the Givney case, where the court says, look, the mere fact that it's written words doesn't mean that the First Amendment is necessarily implicated. So I think that both City of Austin and Rumsfeld and Givney have made clear that mere writing on it does not trigger the First Amendment automatically, and that's, I think, a fundamental error that the district court made. So I think what their applications were a matter of convenience. And we talked about in the stipulated facts the harms that came about because of these erroneous pre-filled applications. We talked about, obviously, the errors in the middle names and initials, and that was conceded. It came from VPC's own witness, which are, talking 15 to 25,000 of them. Our expert witness talked about applications that were sent to individuals who'd been removed from the voting rolls long before the mailing packages were even sent, people who had died, people who had moved. And that caused frustration among the electorate when some of them were sent
died.
In. To,
tell me what problem arises because the person died.
Some of those were actually sent in to the election office. Now, those individuals ultimately did not receive a ballot because the anti-fraud mechanisms kicked in.
That was fraudulent.
What's that?
Those that were sent in.
Some were sent in, and some of them, the voters sent it in because they're saying, wait a minute, why are we getting this? Why would you have sent this? Somebody sent it to me because this individual has died.
But they submitted it so they send it into the election officials, but did they actually send in a request for a ballot?
I don't know that there is evidence that the individuals, that someone sent in an application seeking it on behalf of a deceased person. I mean, the record doesn't say anything on that one way or the other.
Are the cases that are most apt the initiative referendum sorts of cases, someone with a clipboard, please sign, we want to ban nuclear weapons or something like that? That's treated with strict scrutiny, right?
Well, and as we said very clearly, the initiative referendum process is fundamentally different because when you're going around collecting that referendum, the writing itself constitutes expressive speech. The voter's signature, the Reed Court in the Supreme Court, said that the voter's signature on the referendum expresses his view.
So if your opponents were to knock on a door and say, we've got a form here we want you to fill out. Write in on line number 1, John Q. Public, and write on 6, check that you're male, then you're fine with that.
That's perfectly permissible.
Even if it's wrong. Even if it doesn't match Elvis.
Well, the only thing that is impermissible under this statute is the mailing, unsolicited mailing of prefilled applications. Now,
but you're not curing the problem. If you're allowing that, and who knows? They don't know what Elvis has, whether it has a suffix or a middle initial or something, and they just write their name, then it's going to be rejected.
Well, if the VPC were to go to a voter and say, hey, fill this in, and they said, don't worry about what your name is, but write this.
No. Nobody's saying anything like that.
Okay.
I'm saying Jim and James.
Okay.
And you're saying it's okay to knock on the door and say, write James Smith in there. And unbeknownst to everybody, Elvis has it as Jim Smith. It's going to get rejected.
Well, those are issues where the county election office, though, is going to be able to tell who the identity was. But we're talking about the problem here generally has become erroneous middle names and middle initials.
All right. We may be ships in the night, so I don't want to chew up any more of your time.
Okay. I see I'm out of time anyway, so.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Jonathan Youngwood for the appellant. Your Honors, I want to focus on what the district court found regarding much of what was the subject of discussion with counsel, which is that the record suggests on balance that personalizing advanced mail ballot applications actually facilitates orderly and efficient election administration. She reached that conclusion based on a very full record. In front of her were affidavits and depositions from 5 election officials, 2 experts, 2 representatives of my client.
State the conclusion, the finding she made again?
The record suggests that on balance, personalizing advanced mail ballot applications actually facilitates orderly and efficient election administration. So,
and what was that based on? What was the evidence? We heard the evidence that errors in this can cause a lot of problems.
Among other things, Your Honor, the testimony of these election officials, which are summarized in the stipulation facts in the appendix at pages 611, largely through 613 or 614. Included within that is testimony from Mr. Howell that counsel referred to at paragraph 140. Mr. Howell is asked how much time his staff spent curing applications that contain pre-filled information, and he said he doesn't actually count the difference there. And this, again, was their best witness for them. He was asked in paragraph 141 whether it was his opinion that voters become even more confused and frustrated when the application contained pre-filled information. And he's testified, I don't think that the pre-filled information in and of itself was what all the concern was. In fact, if you had a statute...
Is that the same witness who said it took a lot of time, a lot of their time to deal with applications that had been misfilled out in advance?
Yes, but he did not differentiate.
How do you reconcile?
Well, witnesses can be inconsistent, and I submit that's why we have district courts to sort through them.
But what you cited was his saying, we didn't count the time.
Well, there is no testimony that they specifically counted the time. There is no testimony.
So he could still estimate the time and testify to that.
He gives some estimates that obviously if you get a misfilled out ballot, it will take more time to process than a completely...
I just want to clarify this because it's... Yeah. Seems you're both talking about the same witness and saying very different things, and I want to see if there's a new way to reconcile.
Well,
I understood from opposing counsel that this witness said it took a significant amount of time, maybe it was a number, maybe not, to deal with the applications that had erroneous pre-filled out information. Did he not say that?
He does say that, Your Honor, but he also does not have any specific count, and I think what's significant, he draws no distinction, nor could one, I think, between a misfilled pre-printed application and a misfilled handwritten or typed by the individual.
He didn't.
There is no record evidence, nor do I think there's any evidence whatsoever, as to whether pre-filled applications cause more likelihood of error than handwritten applications.
I thought you said 5% of the pre-filled applications. What was that?
That 5% is in the record, Your Honor. That's not what the 5% is. So 5% was an estimate that our client gave at his deposition of nationally of mailers they sent, how many had some form of error. The defendant's expert in this case, taking a sample of the more than 500,000 mailers sent to Kansas citizens, came up with a conclusion that in Kansas it was 3%. But that is 3% of the mailed, not 3% of the received. And so I would submit, for example, if the error was in the address, yeah, it probably was never received and then never sent to the county. There is no evidence of the errors as a percentage or anything, frankly, other than anecdotal of how many errors were sent in from a pre-filled form sent by our client.
And what is the whole form filled out? Is everything?
No, Your Honor, because that's not available.
Do you have to sign them?
You do, Your Honor. And what might be helpful, if you haven't seen it, the form itself as a sample is in the appendix starting at page 674. And what I'd like to do maybe briefly is to get to that question, just to walk through what's in it, because as Your Honors have noted, it's a package. So page 674 is the cover, and for this example, it's to a Jane Smith at 123 Main Street at any town in Kansas. It's just a sample. Ms. Smith gets a letter. This is at page 675, saying, "Dear Jane, county election officials in Kansas encourage voters to use mail ballots in upcoming elections." And that's true. I think that Kansas is a wonderful state in that way. "I've sent you the enclosed advanced ballot by mail application already filled out with your name and address." The letter goes on, and again, there's no dispute here that this letter is speech, and it's not just speech, but it's core political speech entitled to the highest form of protection under the First Amendment. At the bottom of the letter, there's a P.S. "We have already filled in your name and address on the enclosed form. Please take a minute to complete this form, sign and date it, and place the form in the pre-addressed postage paid envelope."
And nothing so far is barred by the statute. It's only the application where you can't insert.
I would say, well, my view, of course, Your Honor, I don't know. I think if the statute is to be enforced in full, I can't write a letter saying, please find a ballot I filled out in part for
The you. Statute says no portion of such application shall be completed prior to mailing such application.
So I could, I suppose, send this letter and then include a blank. The reader would be confused by me saying it, but that is correct. There's nothing illegal about writing this, and they don't challenge the letter.
Okay. So I, regrettably, because of our connectivity here, I can't get the appendix up. But what does the recipient have to fill out?
So page 676, when you have the opportunity,
right.
The recipient would need to, so on this is the name and the address, nothing else, and the county. The recipient needs to give their own driver's license number or non-driver's identification card number. That's not available to our clients through the services. They have to fill that out. They need to fill out under item 4, the address to where the mail ballot should be sent. So somebody's filling, you gotta fill that out or it's not gonna work. And they need to sign it, date it, put their phone number.
How about the date of the election? That looks like that's filled in.
That is the date.
Paragraph.
Yes, it is, right in paragraph 5 before the signature.
Okay, and
that's pre-filled, you say?
The date of the election to which you're requesting the ballot.
And that helps, right? Because most people don't know the day of the election.
I would think you probably, again, Your Honor, there is no evidence. I'm just giving you a common sense. I would think that if this information Go ahead, Your Honor.
I want to make sure I understand. So that is part, so it's the name and address plus the date of the election are pre-filled out.
That is correct.
Okay.
And the county.
And the county, and nothing else.
And yet there are significant things that need to be filled in by the applicant, the driver's license number, the address to send the ballot. Does it really make any difference? I guess I'm wondering, I know that here we are in federal court, but aren't most people going to know their name and fill it in?
I think, Your Honor, it gets to why my client does this, and they do this because their message is voting by mail is easy, safe, and you can do it. And we've gone to the trouble ourselves of populating this. That's a strength of the speech. It goes to, I think, the volume and the magnitude of the speech. And it goes to, frankly, under this court's precedents and the Supreme Court precedents, it's up to the speaker to decide how their speech can be most effective.
Okay.
And the reason our client does is they think it conveys a stronger message by doing this.
All right. One thing that I'm trying to get to the bottom of, and that I think I know the answer to, all of the commotion about it's creating all these problems, there are mismatches and so forth, you have two possibilities. Number one, you don't pre-fill, and you get a certain number that the middle initial is wrong or something, or you don't. You do pre-fill and that happens, or you don't pre-fill, there's still going to be mismatches with Elvis, right? Someone's going to write Jim instead of Jane.
So, Your Honor, the errors here came from a vendor who didn't purely pull Elvis. You could. We don't have that statute here.
But if Elvis is the be-all, end-all, it's the match that you have to avoid a problem.
Yep.
The person filling in the application doesn't know how their name is on Elvis.
Absolutely, sir.
And so that person can inadvertently make a mistake that causes rejection by using a Jim or James, just like the pre-filled can.
Correct, Your Honor. And if the pre-filled came from Elvis, there'd actually be a lower risk of error than a higher risk.
Can you do better? Your organizations, which is to say it comes from commercial and it gets contaminated with that and time lags, people have died, moved, so forth. Why shouldn't you be held to something that requires Elvis within a certain amount of time?
Your Honor, that would be a different law, and I'd have to have different arguments if I wanted to challenge it. If you go to, and it goes to under strict scrutiny, what's the least restrictive mean of satisfying an overriding state interest? I understand preventing election fraud is definitely an overriding state interest, but there is absolutely no evidence that this statute was directed to that. And listening to the prior argument, it bears mentioning, and it's in the stipulated facts at 138, there's no legislative history here supporting any of the reasons. But if your concern is confusion or duplicates, there are many less restrictive means. For example, if your concern is duplicates, you could have passed a law that says, like, my client sent these to people up to five times. You could say one. I don't think that's a law we would support, but I have to come up with a different challenge to it. You could say it has to come from Elvis, and it has to come from Elvis within a certain number of weeks or months, because where the Elvis will differ from reality is, I don't know, somebody gets married and he or she changes their name.
So you're saying there are least restrictive ways of doing this?
This statute fails that test. If their concern were duplicates, voter confusion, inaccuracies, there are, and it's, I can't come up with all of them, but they're significantly less restrictive means.
And we know why that matters with heightened scrutiny. Does it matter for Anderson Burdick?
So we don't think Anderson Burdick applies. It's not content neutral. This is not a content neutral statute.
Would it matter for Anderson Burdick?
Well, under Anderson Burdick, it would then, if it did, it would go to whether or not this imposes a substantial burden. And we would argue that even under Anderson Burdick, you would get there that this statute isn't properly crafted. And you didn't ask, but even under intermediate scrutiny, which we do not believe you get to, obviously to a somewhat lesser degree, it's a substantial state interest rather than an overriding. And the words are different, and I agree, lesser than strict scrutiny. But this statute would not survive intermediate scrutiny, and it would not survive an Anderson Burdick analysis.
Let me
pursue some of this. You're satisfied with the question?
Satisfied. More known.
I'm curious, what is the expressive? What is being expressed? What is the expressed message by filling out the form? And why isn't filling a ban on filling out the form not just the time, place, and manner restriction? You can say anything you want. Whatever you're trying to express here, you just can't do it on that form.
So, Your Honor, on time, place, and manner, which in part, I think,
first
was...
First, go to the expressive part, if you will.
I'm going to express it first. Sure, Your Honor. Give me 1 second. So, first of all, Your Honor, the form is not just part of the package. We would say it's the centerpiece of the package. And so, as the briefs argue, it's integrated. They've conceded the letters for political speech. The letters tied to it.
Say we were to think that the only thing banned by the statute is filling out the form. What expression are you losing?
Let's say all we did was send the form, no letter. Because I think with the letter, the letter carries it whether or not.
But I'd rather you answer my question if you want to answer your question.
So what is expressive about the form is it says to
about
the voter...
Filling out
the form.
Yes.
This is how easy it is to fill it out. We've started the process for you. That's one. Two, one would assume that it cost us some amount of resources to fill it out. And we are saying we care so much about voting by mail that we've taken a step for you in that direction by taking the care. I recognize if it's an error, there's less care, but by taking the care to pre-populate it.
That sounds like an expression, but it's expressive conduct. By doing this, we're expressing something. It's not that the filling out the form itself is the expression, but by doing this, we've expressed something.
That is correct, but that falls within this circuit's Kressman decision. We think it falls within the Supreme Court's Clark test. So what's the Clark test? Is it intended to be commutative? That's not disputed. That's accepted by the other side, that this was intended by our client subjectively to be commutative. And in context, would reasonably be understood by the viewer to be communicative. So the question, which the district court, hearing all the evidence, ruled on, is getting a packet where the form's filled out versus not filled out, will that say something to somebody?
So, but then the question is, isn't this restriction essentially a time, place, and manner restriction on that expression?
You can
picketing is expressive conduct, but you can't do it in certain places, certain times.
So counsel cited City of Austin. Again, court will look at it itself. That's a clear time, place, and manner way to location. Location of speech, not whether there was speech. And then the Rumsfeld or...
I'm being simple-minded. It says you can do this anywhere except on these documents. Why is that not a limitation on time, place, and manner?
Because the act of putting them on the documents is the speech or the expression. We're saying fill out a form. We believe you should fill it out. We've started it for you. And, Your Honor, it differs from the Rumsfeld case that they've cited extensively. And that was a case involving the military recruiters on campus, and what does it mean if you don't have a military recruiter, and do you need to have a statement with it? And the court there, cited by this district court, but by the Supreme Court, says when you're asking a military recruiter to be off campus, it's a little unclear, or let me say it differently, because to ask is to tell people, so I have to take that out. When somebody sees the military recruiter is off campus, what does that mean? Well, as the Supreme Court held, it could mean that your rooms were full and there wasn't room for them. It could mean that the recruiter chose to be off campus for some reason, or it could mean that the institution didn't want them there. And so without an additive statement, we don't know what it meant. Go ahead, Your Honor.
I just realized that time's going over. Do you have any questions?
No.
Do you have anything?
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. A minute and a half.
Just a few points quickly. The first is that I would urge this court to read the Sixth Circuit's recent decision in Lichtenstein, which in that case, the Tennessee had prohibited the distribution of any absentee ballot applications, whether they were pre-filled or not, and the Sixth Circuit upheld that under the O'Brien intermediate scrutiny. But I would also simply point out, Your Honors, that they themselves, when we talked about, what are the harms here, they themselves, the VPC, was sufficiently concerned about the erroneous applications that they stopped in pre-filling them on two of the five mailings that they sent out to voters. So, I mean, that is incredibly powerful evidence that the state's harms here were not made up and that the legislature had very solid reasons for engaging in this activity.
Well, their concern might not be the same as yours. Yours is the burden on the election officials, and theirs is wasting people's time.
Even the voters were so concerned, Your Honor, that they included a Q&A in their call center that for voters to address voters calling in saying, hey, I was sent an erroneous application, or I was sent an application for someone else, what should I do? And they encouraged them to request a different application. So these are not made up harms at all. And finally, I would just note that the standard on, so I think that even if you find that there is some expressive activity, we win on the intermediate scrutiny or Anderson Burdick, whichever one you choose. But I would also simply point out that under the Rumsfeld standard, the expression, the communicative conduct has to be overwhelmingly apparent. At the end of the day here, what they've done is simply a matter of convenience.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Very interesting argument. Counsel are excused. Case is submitted.